Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution from Ross and Joanne Butzo in honor of their grandson, Gage Glaspa, on his 6th birthday.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. For the first time since January, the U.S. Army has announced that it has met its recruiting goal for the month of June. The Army Reserve also made its first monthly goal since last December. However, there is still concern in the Pentagon that overall the recruiting goal for this year will not be met. The numbers that I've just mentioned here still leaves the active duty Army about 7,800 recruits behind schedule. They have just 3 months to go in the recruiting year that ends September 30th. The Army has not missed its annual enlistment quota since 1999. The question we'll take up this morning is, how is it that the Army is going to continue, or will it be able to continue, and more broadly, not just the Army, but the U.S. military, to attract recruits? And one of the questions we'll be talking about is it at all possible, can one imagine that here in the United States we would see a return to a military draft? Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeffrey Reckard. He's professor in the Department of Strategy and International Security at the U.S. Air Force Air War College. He has a Ph.D. from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He has been at Brookings, at the Brookings Institution, as a member of the Defense Analysis Staff. He has been senior fellow at the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis at the Hudson Institute. He also has extensive Capitol Hill experience. He served as legislative assistant for national security affairs to both Senators Sam Nunn and Lloyd Benson. He also served as professional staff member of the Senate Armed Services Committee and has written four books and a number of papers dealing with military issues, particularly dealing with Vietnam, where he served. Questions this morning are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. We ask that people who call in just try to be brief in their comments, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, callers are welcome. That's the idea here. In Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois or Indiana. Also, if you might happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, or WILO, if that makes it any easier, 333-WILO. The toll-free, 800-222-9455. And as I say, at any point here, people have questions, you're welcome to call. Professor Reckard, hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Not bad.
Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Well, I suppose that this is good news for the Pentagon, that now they have met their goal for at least the Army has met its goal for June. And I think actually it had been expected that once we moved into the summer, the numbers would go up. Perhaps the issue is here we do have some people who have graduated from high school and they're trying to figure out what they're wanting to do. So maybe that's not a surprise. There has been a little bit of an uptick. But overall, certainly over the past few months, they have had the difficulty meeting those numbers. So have the Marines. So has the National Guard. And so we come to the question, and perhaps it's an obvious question, why do you think it is that the Army, the Marines, the Guard is having such a tough time finding the number of recruits that they feel they need?
Well, the Army and the Marine Corps and their reserve components, particularly the Army reserve components, are the ones that are bearing the brunt of the war in Iraq. Navy recruiting and Air Force recruiting is not suffering similar difficulties, largely because they are not nearly as exposed to casualties as are the ground forces. So I think as long as you have a situation where you have an ongoing counterinsurgent war in Iraq and a kind of steady drip of U.S. casualties in terms of dead and wounded, and we're over 1,700 killed now and about 13,000 wounded. About half of those 13,000 were lightly wounded; the rest were more seriously wounded. That's not much of an incentive to join up. And even if you're predisposed to join the military under these circumstances, you would probably maybe want to join the Air Force or the Navy, where your chances of of getting a shot at in Iraq would be considerably less.
Yeah. As I mentioned, and it's my understanding here from just having read the newspaper story just come out this morning, that there are just 3 months to go in the recruiting year. So we have July, August, September, and there is this concern that overall, and this is, again, we're talking about the Army here, that it wouldn't meet the annual goal for recruiting, and that it's been a long time since that has happened. Do you, in fact, think, or do you think the expectation of people who pay attention to these things is that chances are the Army will not meet the goal, will fall short?
I think the chances are better than 50-50 that the Army will not meet the goal. And again, the Army is, even more so than the Marine Corps, is bearing the major brunt of this conflict. And you have about 40 to 45% of the Army forces in Iraq are reservists. And this is not what they signed up for. I mean, when you signed up for the reserves in the old days, you expected maybe to be deployed once every, 10, 12 years, if at all. Here you've got reservists, some of whom have completed two tours of duty in Iraq, and it's been very, very disruptive in terms of their private lives, in terms of their family lives, and in terms of their jobs and so on.
Mm-hmm. Something else that also I think that is striking that is slightly different but related, and that has to do with the fact that I believe that this is true, that for the first time since September 11th, when we saw, at that point, we saw a very dramatic increase in the numbers of young men and women applying to go to the service academies, to go into the officer corps. And now for the first time, we have seen that drop off. In addition, apparently there has been an increase in the number of people who are in the officer corps, particularly younger people who have decided that they're not going to pursue a military career. Do you think that in the future that it will be more difficult to find enough people to fill all the various spots that we need to fill in the among the officer corps?
Well, that depends upon what the strategic situation is. I mean, if we are still in Iraq 5 years from now, and if there's been other wars that have broken out that we've been involved in, I mean, I think attitudes towards military service will be significantly influenced by the risk involved. And certainly in the case of reservists who lead other lives than their reserve lives, this could have profound influence on the ability to recruit reservists and to retain them. I mean, I think part of this is there's been a general decline of in public support for the Iraq War. You now have, for the first time since the Iraq War began, you have a majority of Americans who believe that the war was probably a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether those trends continue and whether or not the president's speech the other night is going to make a difference in those numbers, it's too early to say.
Do you think that, can one say that the difficulties right at the moment that the military is having in attracting recruits at the entry-level position, so to speak, and perhaps also in persuading people that being an officer in the military would be a good career, is this bad for the military? Or if the answer to the question is yes, it's bad for the military, in what way is it bad for the military?
Well, I think, you have a situation where you have an ongoing war, and the end of that war is certainly not anywhere in sight. You have an all-volunteer force that you have essentially recruited on the basis of appeals to patriotism, but also in terms of being able to maintain rough comparability in pay and benefits to equivalent jobs in the civilian sector. And you've had a war that has been unexpected in its duration and in its casualties, and very disruptive in terms of, particularly for the ground forces, in terms of pulling people into repeated tours in Iraq. It's been hard on marriages, it's been hard on families, it's been hard on as war generally is. So this is not something new. This is something that we've experienced before. Although in the old days, of course, when you had conscription, you could make up any shortfalls in manpower by simply going out and drafting whatever you needed.
Well, that was one of the questions that we wanted to deal with, and since it has come up, why did I do that? And that, in fact, that was one of the first questions we thought of discussing, and then I think we all decided that that would be a pretty short discussion, and we needed to perhaps find some way to broaden that to talk about some more general issues. But I think that it is on the minds of some people, so the question is, do you think that there is any possibility that we would see a return to a draft?
I don't see any political support for it. You had a recent national public opinion poll which showed that 70 or 71% of Americans oppose conscription. The military is opposed to conscription. There is no sentiment in the Congress, aside from a couple of people, for conscription. The administration is opposed to conscription. The Democratic Party is opposed to conscription. I don't see where the political support for conscription comes from. It is simply not a popular idea. And even if you suddenly decided that maybe we ought to return to conscription, you would have a lot of very nutty questions to ask. Are you going to conscript women? Are you going to go back to a system of deferments and exemptions? If so, who gets deferred and on what basis, and who gets exempted and on what basis? And there's all kinds of equity issues and so on. So, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why people are not enthusiastic about going back to the draft. It is difficult to make a military case for the draft. The draft usually involves large numbers of people coming in for relatively short tours of duty, 2 years, maybe tops. Modern warfare requires levels of training and skill you simply can't give anybody in 2 years. So there are some good strategic arguments, military arguments, against a return to the draft. The alternative, of course, would be to simply jack up pay and benefits and other non-monetary incentives to keep enough people in the military and to recruit new ones when it's necessary.
Which is what that seems to be the strategy so far, is to try to
offer. That has been the strategy so far. They have, they have doubled the signing bonus. They have reduced the active duty tour of duty. They are looking at expanding benefits and so on. And that has been the traditional way by which we have sustained the all-volunteer force.
Yeah. I have a couple of callers here, and I want to promise these people I will not make them wait forever. We'll get to them in just a second. Let me just ask, though, one further question. Given the fact that we say for a variety of reasons it's not likely we're going to go back to drafting people, then that we're then stuck with what we've got here, and in any way try to persuade people to voluntarily sign up. But the difficulties that the military has had in recruiting people at all levels does raise, in my mind at least, the question, does this in fact call into question the very idea of the all-volunteer force?
Well, I think it does, and there's the issue of, can you sustain an all-volunteer force in the kind of society in which we live, particularly an all-volunteer force that's being stressed the way it's being stressed in Iraq. There are some larger issues of social equity out there, and that is, why should the sons and daughters of the rich and privileged be exempt from defending their country by virtue of their educational and financial status. This is a problem we wrestle with even when we had the draft in Vietnam, because the deferments and exemption system that we went into Vietnam with was such that it allowed the better educated and the better off financially to avoid military service, or at least to have better choices inside the military once they went in.
We have a couple of callers. We'll get right to them. I should also introduce again the guest for this hour for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. We're speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Reckard. He's professor in the Department of Strategy and International Security at the U.S. Air Force Air War College. He has authored a number of books and papers dealing with subjects including military strategy, U.S. force structure. He's also written about Vietnam and about the first Gulf War. He has worked at the Brookings Institution, at the Hudson Institute. He's also have quite a bit of experience on Capitol Hill. He was legislative assistant for national security affairs to Senators Sam Nunn and Lloyd Benson, and also was a staff member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. First caller in line here is in Rentoul and on line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Morning, sir. Yeah, I just retired out of 37 years and retired as senior Army medical officer out of Fort Sheridan command staff. I think the recruiting thing has multiple things. One of the things is VA Secretary Nicholson confirmed in Congress yesterday that the casualty count for Gulf War II and Afghanistan is now at 103,000. And as a consequence, he's $1 billion short.
Yeah.
That's having a horrible effect. The casualties are coming back, and from Gulf War I, I was on command staff there. This is totally confirmed VA data. We're looking at 325,000.
Yeah.
Already from Gulf War I, and now we're another 103,000 for Gulf War II. And the medical care is just not available. So as far as trying to recruit individuals or keep people in, we can't get it done.
Well, I think you're
problems.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that any potential recruiter is going to look at is what kind of, you know, as a veteran at some point, what kind of medical and other care can I expect? And that has been a sore issue for a lot of veterans for quite a long time. And you're right. I mean, I think we really have to get our Veterans Administration house in order, in our veterans programs in order. Again, this is expensive stuff. In order to sustain the all-volunteer force, I mean that's part of the that ought to be part of the moral contract that we make with young folks who are entering military service.
The serious problem there is some of my old colleagues, Bill Winkenwerder and Mike Kilpatrick, up at SecDef level. They made a conscious choice on, you know, reducing the medical forces and the medical assistance and everything, both on the active and then what's going to happen in the VA. The other thing that's really happening is we're having the ethical moral dilemma crisis. We plan, you know, Gulf War II, as you're totally aware, was Operation Blue Devil back in the 90s under the Clinton directives, and then he finally launched it. But all that stuff was based on everything. So we're seeing the crisis in the command staff and the enlisted saying, okay, this is what it was justified and based on, and this is the reality. And they're going, no, wait a minute. You know, there's a big difference here between what the president's telling and what the reality is, and that's really also having a horrible effect. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that, and then I'll hang up.
Well, I think, you know, that there were a number of assumptions, initial assumptions made about the degree of difficulty that we would encounter in overthrowing the regime in Iraq, and I don't think anybody really expected. I don't know of anybody who expected the emergence of a persistent and seemingly open-ended insurgency against the occupation. I mean, at the time, you were reading stories in the New York Times about the Pentagon assuming that they could get away with that this would be short and sweet, that this would be a liberation scenario. Nobody anticipated the administrative collapse of the Ba'athist government. Nobody anticipated the emergence of an insurgency. The assumption was is that there would be a clean and politically decisive military win that would permit the United States to draw down its forces in Iraq, maybe down to even 30,000 by the end of 2003. Now, of course, all those assumptions proved wrong. But had they been right, I don't think we would have the kind of recruiting and retention crisis that we have today in our ground forces, simply because there would be no ongoing war that would be acting as a deterrent to many potential recruits out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Let's continue. We have someone next in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, Doctor, I wonder if you'd comment on the TV commercials for recruitment. I think they're quite ineffective. It shows a young man climbing up a mountain side and then later swinging a sword and slaying a dragon. I'm thinking, if I were a young man and I'm seeing a young man climb up a mountain, I'm thinking, well, I wouldn't have to enlist if I wanted to kill or injure myself climbing up a mountain for adventure. I would want to know, what's the enlistment bonus? What's the variety? How many types of skills could I learn? How much money can I get when I get out and go to college? Those are the types of things I'd like to learn rather than the potential to dangle on the side of a mountain.
Well, I'm not an advertising expert, and certainly I would not be in a position to comment on a specific TV commercial. But in the larger issue, you're absolutely right, and that is that we have managed to sustain the all volunteer force only through provision of roughly comparable pay to the equivalent position in civilian society, and a number of non-monetary benefits such as college education and so on that have attracted recruits, particularly people that come from socioeconomic statuses that would make college or make these benefits very, very difficult to obtain outside of military service. So, you know, the question is, you know, at some point there has to be a constant adjustment of pay and benefits to keep the all-volunteer force competitive with the civilian sector of the economy. And that competitiveness becomes particularly difficult to maintain if you're in the middle of the kind of counterinsurgent war that we're in the middle of, and particularly for the ground forces, you're recycling units over there for two and even three tours, and that's not you know, getting a college education and getting a free college education isn't going to do much for you if you get killed on your tour of duty. So that, you know, there has to be a constant adjustment of pay and benefits within the context of what is going on in the world and what is going on in the civilian sector of the economy in order to sustain the all-volunteer force.
Well, thank you.
All right, let's go to Champaign again. Another caller here, line number three. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Well, there's several points raised. First of all, I would say that one of the big reasons why we're not going to see a draft is because it would completely evaporate political support for the kinds of wars that the current administration is, you know, taking us into. If you think that things were bad during Vietnam, I think that you'd see an incredible ground protest. I mean, there's already protests across the nation, let alone the world. But it would be much stronger, and especially if you didn't have deferments for wealthier people, and especially for members of Congress's kids, you know, I think that there just wouldn't be the support to kind of go off on these kinds of wars. Secondly, we're kind of moving into a mercenary army. There are a lot of private, military, paramilitary type people in Iraq right now operating. And, I guess
I think your points are well taken. And as you may recall, during the discussions in the early 1970s about getting rid of conscription and going to an all-volunteer force, there were a number of liberals who questioned the idea of the wisdom of going to the all-volunteer force, because they felt that all-volunteer army would be an army that presidents could use with greater domestic political impunity overseas than otherwise would be the case. The assumption was is that as long as you had draftees in there, there were limits on a president's ability and willingness to use them in wars overseas, particularly wars that may not be particularly popular. You have. I don't know whether that's true or not. The Army made sure as it came out of Vietnam that it would never permit another president to commit the Army in force the way Lyndon Johnson committed it without calling up the reserves. And they changed the relationship between the active duty portion of the Army and the reserve portion to make it impossible for presidents to go to a big war overseas without mobilizing reserves. And the belief was that mobilization of people out of civilian life would essentially act as a political check on presidents that were eager for kind of foreign military adventures. You've raised the issue of mercenaries, which is, I think, that's a derogatory term, but we are contracting out a lot of our security functions in Iraq to private companies that employ, in many cases, former U.S. Soldiers in private security capacity. And I think we should remember that both the British and the French army still retain mercenary units. These are paid, hired foreigners, and you can, in the case of the French Foreign Legion, in the case of the Gurkha units in the British Army, I don't know how many are left, but there used to be quite substantial numbers of them. And I think that nobody wants to use that term, but I think that one of the options that you would look at to solve a recruiting and retention crisis would be the idea of perhaps hiring foreigners who are seeking American citizenship and who seek to come to the United States. The deal would be that if you serve X number of years in the U.S. military, you're automatically a citizen and maybe will throw in a college education as well. That idea has been discussed, although nobody that I know of, I mean, there's certainly no great political groundswell behind it.
Well, I guess I would also challenge your earlier assertion that nobody foresaw the coming of a large-scale occupation. There were a number of people, although they weren't getting, they weren't being allowed to be pundits on the major media so much, but there were certainly people not only, out in the public, but also within the military themselves that were saying that, we had to have a much bigger force. You weren't going to be able to control things. And, especially when they immediately put off the elections and they closed down the Iraqi army and sent all these people, away, there were a lot of people who were actually saying that, you're going to have an insurgency,
yes.
You're going to have a battle on your hands. And
but they had no influence on policy. I guess I should qualify it by that. Yes, of course there were people, the Army Chief of Staff himself, General Shinseki, who was then the Army Chief of Staff, went up on Capitol Hill and said, you're going to need several hundred thousand people to do this thing in Iraq, and even once the Ba'athist regime falls, because our own army studies and experience in the Balkans and so on has shown that you need this many people in order to be able to secure the country and to establish order. And of course, the people that were the Office of the Secretary of Defense said dismissed that out of hand. I mean, you had people who simply did not want to hear that. But you're absolutely right. There were a lot of professionals, both at the State Department and in the Army, who anticipated the possibility of trouble in an occupied Iraq, and who had looked at past experience of U.S. occupations, including more recent occupations in the Balkans, and had concluded that we were going to need a lot more boots on the ground, as they say, in Iraq than in fact were sent in to invade the country.
I guess if I were a professional person in the military, I would be very upset with the current administration for their incompetence. And I see them really as damaging the United States military to the point where it's going to take decades for them to overcome. But thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just for a moment to return to the subject of private contractors, something that has gotten a fair amount of attention in the media. There's been reporting on the fact that there are private contractors that are providing a wide range of services. There are including things like equipment maintenance,
sure.
And food service and things like that. And also there are private contractors that are providing people who carry guns and
yes.
who provide security functions. And as you say, one of the concerns has been that the private contractors, because they can offer very attractive salaries, are drawing off from the military soldiers, very experienced soldiers with high levels of training. And that's a loss for the military. But I guess one of the things I wonder is, are we really talking about numbers that are sufficient enough to cause a problem? And can we say that part of the staffing problems we have are because private contractors are hiring off experienced soldiers?
I don't think the numbers are large enough to have any kind of strategic consequence. But I think at the in one sense, yeah, I mean, that's a factor. You get some guy who goes into Special Operations Forces, does his tour of duty, gets all trained up at U.S. government expense. Comes time for him to reenlist. Maybe he'll reenlist for one or two terms. Then some guy from a private security company walks up to him and says, "You sure you want to reenlist? I can give you $1,500 a day, $2,000 a day, tax free or whatever, come work with me, and you'll live a lot better life, and you'll be able to accumulate a lot more money over a shorter period of time. That can be a pretty attractive incentive, and you know, therefore you essentially have again, when you went to the all volunteer force, you put recruitment, you got into competition with market forces, and market forces not only in terms of non-military job competition, but now you have the competition of private security companies that are hiring military former military folks in the same way that airlines used to hire former Air Force pilots.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, the need for soldiers is putting a lot of pressure on recruiters. And also, the spotlight has been put on recruiters because of questions about methods. Certainly, the need for soldiers is putting a lot of pressure on them. And among the things I have read is that, for example, that recruiters are having to spend more for every person that they recruit. They're spending more hours in the process of doing that, a lot more than they had before. For example, here there's a story in today's New York Times that quotes folks in the Marines saying that Marine recruiters now are spending an average of 12 hours per recruit they enlist, and that's up from about 3 a year ago. Is part of the issue here the kind of resources that the military puts into recruiting, and would it help if, you know, we'll set aside the issue of are there staff and is there money and whatever complications. But if we just said, ask the question, well, is part of the problem that we need more recruiters, would that help?
I don't know that I can really answer that question. But obviously, if the workload of recruiters is going up, and if the number of hours that they have to spend per recruit is going up, at some point, you're going to need more folks. Unless for some reason some other incentive comes out there to make your recruiting job easier. But all of the accounts that I've read suggest that certainly Marine and especially Army recruiters are under growing stress because the market is not what it used to be, and the war is exerting a chilling effect not only on just a lot of potential recruits, but on the parents of potential recruits. Who are, you know, becoming now part of the equation, parents that are essentially working on their sons and daughters not to join the military for fear of getting shot in Iraq. Mm.
That's something that we have not touched on yet, but again, it's something that we read about a lot, and that is contributing to the difficulty the military is having in attracting recruits. That is, parents of potential recruits saying to their kids, I don't want you going in the military, saying to recruiters, I don't want you talking to my children. This would be a difficult thing to measure, the role that parental pressure or parental feelings enters, just to what extent that enters into the whole issue?
I'm not sure, because the only stuff I know about it is pretty much anecdotal. I don't know of any systematic study that's been done of parental pressure on potential recruits not to be even interviewed, much less join up. But you do hear lots of stories because, you know, the same parents that are watching the TV and watching the car bombs go off, and maybe they're not enthusiastic about the war to begin with. And again, this is all taking place against the backdrop of declining public support for the war and for the first time, a majority of Americans, according to the latest poll data, believing that the war was a mistake in the first place. You know, this could all change if the insurgency were to surrender or be decisively defeated, and the U.S. casualty rate were to go down and so on, and there would be real political progress in Iraq. I mean, if things look quite differently in Iraq 2 or 3 years from now, this may not have the same kind of situation that you have in terms of the recruiting crisis.
Let's talk with another caller here, line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I find interesting in the current problem with recruitment is the degree to which the problem is shoved off onto the professional military, and our political class, our columnists, people who generally favor the war, local civic leaders, no one is willing to step forward. You don't hear of any recruitment rallies, recruitment drives. The president himself can only talk about it in the most tepid terms in his speech the other night. I think there was one sentence telling young people that if they examine their conscience and they're interested in volunteering, that might be a good thing to do. But my sense is that the people are afraid to get behind recruitment because it will cast the spotlight on where the children of the politically well-connected are, and they're not in the military. So for the President Bush to start appearing at public rallies that are called recruitment rallies would highlight that, you know, nobody in his family can find the time to go.
And well, you know, there's always been
I think that's true all throughout Congress and outside of Congress. Our political, our civic leaders, our columnists, people who are generally supportive of the war, no one is willing to put forward a call that, in this context, patriotism means your willingness to go do this. Patriotism now simply is wave the flag on the 4th of July, but this embarrassing problem of recruitment is one that's just shoved aside to the military recruiters who themselves are, you know, one has sympathy for them because it's a really distasteful job, and I just read that they've got a problem with recruiters going AWOL now because they can't live with their conscience any longer.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the argument, there's always the moral argument, and this goes back as far as Plato's Republic, that the sons and daughters, certainly the sons of those who make the decisions for war ought to be liable for military service, and that the political class, those who make these decisions as a whole, indeed it should be an honor, that noblesse oblige kind of thing, that you should look forward to military service because that was your obligation as a privileged member of society. And I think you can look at George H.W. Bush, the president's father, in that light as a young man who came from a very, very privileged situation and who immediately walked down and joined up when World War II started. You're absolutely right. How many sons and daughters of members of Congress or of the cabinet are serving in the military at all, much less in Iraq? I expect the number is fairly low. But you know, we've been there before on this. We had a very inequitable draft system during the Vietnam War, which essentially permitted the better educated and the financially better off to avoid military service altogether, or certainly to avoid service in combat in Southeast Asia, with a lot of lesser privileged people serving in their place. About 80% of the line infantry, U.S. line infantry in Vietnam, were working-class kids.
But apart from reinstituting the draft, the fear of people who generally are in support of the war to even speak out and say, people need to volunteer. So you hear people say, well, this is an important war, it's a necessary war. Our local newspaper, the News Gazette, which is generally conservative and supportive of the war, has never editorialized, say, around graduation time and say, high school graduates or college graduates, now's the time for you to step forward and do your duty. And I believe that, I mean, I do think that there's a little bit of a fear of talking about that because the spotlight will be turned back on one's own family and friends and their lack of willingness.
I think you're probably right. And you know, there is this phenomenon, what I would call couch potato patriotism that requires no exertion and no effort and no sacrifice. I mean, gosh, this is the first major war we've waged without even raising taxes. On the contrary, we've lowered taxes. So, you know, who's being, other than the men and women in uniform who are serving tours of duty or who have served tours of duty in Iraq, who's being asked to sacrifice anything for this war? Nobody, as far as I can tell.
Well, we're being asked to sacrifice our privacy. So, you know, when we go to the library, someone might be looking at what we check out.
That's another topic for another day.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, if you take a look at over time, what have been the various reasons for people to serve in the military, to voluntarily serve? And there could be a number of things. It could be a desire to serve their country. It could be for the adventure. It could be to have a job And probably in more recent years, it could be to get an education or get that education paid for, get some high-tech training. And sort of depending upon what's going on at any time, it may be one more of one of these things than the other. Do you think, though, that really what we have to do is at this point and be realistic and say perhaps for the foreseeable future, the main reason that anybody's going to make this choice is to have a job? It's going to be for the money, essentially, and that if we have to face the reality that says that if we're going to get the numbers of people that we want, that simply we're going to have to pay for it. It's just going to be a matter of finding out what it's going to take and then essentially writing the check.
Well, I don't want to suggest that you know that the mercenary motive is the primary and certainly the only motive of people that are joining. I myself know young folks who have joined the military and who've done so out of a sense of obligation to the greater good and out of a sense of patriotism and out of a sense of obligation to defend America. But you know, on the other hand, they've got to be able to survive materially, and they got to have a salary, and they've got to have some benefits. So I suspect that people join the military not for a particular motive, one here and one there, but mm-hmm. probably for a variety of motives. But I mean, I think at a minimum, we have to make military service economically competitive. You know, in the draft, you could afford to pay your PFC $30 a month. Considerably less than he would make somewhere else in the private sector, because you had control of him. I mean, he didn't have anywhere to go. You just said you're serving, and that's it. So I think you know, clearly the military right now, the Army and the Marine Corps right now, have been engaged in increases in order to deal with this recruiting crisis. Have been jacking up pay, benefits, and signing bonuses, and so on. They see that as the immediate near-term solution to this problem. And it seems to me you're going to see more of that if, in fact, this crisis continues.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to suggest that there wasn't anybody that was interested in joining the military out of a desire for public service to the country. Because I'm sure that there is. And there are people like that. And I'm sure that there are also that still people join for the idea that they think that it's going to be an adventure.
Oh, yeah.
For that,
yeah.
Too. And I'm sure that all of that is in there. But as we've discussed, though, I think that more and more, it may be at least that we're going to have to strengthen that other leg, that is the financial incentive.
Right? And I think that's what they're doing, even as we speak.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Dr. Jeffrey Reckard. He's professor in the Department of Strategy and International Security at the U.S. Air Force Air War College. He has a Ph.D. from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's been at the Brookings Institution as part of their defense analysis staff. He was a senior fellow at the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis at the Hudson Institute. He's also experienced on Capitol Hill. He served as legislative assistant for national security affairs to Senator Sam Nunn and Lloyd Benson. He also served as a professional staff member of the Senate Armed Services Committee and has written a number of books and papers on Vietnam, on the first Gulf War, and also on military strategy and force structure. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. We're headed here into about our last 7-8 minutes. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller in Champaign County, and this is line 2.
Hi, good morning. I was the brouhaha. Some of the brouhaha about the draft started when there was a posting on the Selective Service website calling for people to volunteer to be on the local councils. I just went there now, and you can't find anything about any local councils.
Yeah.
You can't find anything about any local councils in the phone book either. I don't know. I've heard of people who thought it was their patriotic duty and who were relatively anti-militarist to join their selective services to in anticipation of the possibility of a draft. You haven't mentioned this database business. It seems that the Pentagon has gotten around this as far as recruiting goes. They seem to have skirted the law that disallows the Pentagon from amassing a database of personal information by just contracting it out to a company, and it's fairly invasive. It's getting a lot of more libertarian people worried, along with all of the other aforementioned or alluded to assaults on liberty. I have a rather straightforward question at the very end, but I wanted to mention also that the poverty draft does extend to Central America, at least as far as your comments about recruiting people who are not citizens. There have been advertisements all through Central America. I don't know if they're working very well, and maybe they've stopped advertising people to people that this was their way to get a green card, was to join the Army for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
So that's right. That has been done. The specific question, and there's a lot there to react to, is that I've also heard that people analyzing the force structure, seeing that a fair number of mid-levels in the officer corps are not re-upping, I think, both in the Army and the Marines. And I don't know whether they're going over to being private contractors or whether they're just disgusted with the circumstance or what their motivations are at this point. As far as private contractors, I have one just a remark on that, which is that there was actually a firefight between private contractors and regular Army, and, you know, it was an accidental firefight, but it left both sides extremely angry. The esprit de corps between the two factions is not high at all, and I heard this characterized on NPR as misbehavior by private contractors. I don't think that was appropriate at all, and I guess I'm criticizing the media I'm calling in on. But
one can speculate that in the serving Army units, there has to be some disaffection with private contractors who have been skimming people out of the Army and who are paying them more and so on. I mean, that's speculation on my part. There are some other issues related to private contractors that also need to be addressed, and that is, what is their legal status? I mean, are they bound by the laws of war? Are they what is their legal status? Are there things that they can do? Are there uses of force that they can engage in? Their treatment of prisoners that they can engage in that the Army can't? I mean, it seems to me that I don't have any objection in principle to hiring private contractors, or if you want to use the term mercenaries. But the British and the French have showed, certainly the British have shown, that you can hire mercenaries and keep them well disciplined and so on. But I think these issues need to be clarified.
There has yet been no case of a private contractor being brought to any kind of docket in Iraq, as far as
I don't know of any. But I don't keep track of that. So
there has been a lawsuit against. What about? Are you hearing that there's a exodus from the mid-level of in Iraq?
I've read that in some of the newspapers. Yeah, and it certainly would be consistent with the overall recruiting and retention crisis. The Army has doubled its signing bonus to $40,000. Extraordinary, and they're looking at retention bonuses as well. Again, there's nothing new about this, just the size, the amount that's involved, which is an indicator of how serious the crisis is.
What about local selective service councils? Is that still the nominal
I'm not
reserve?
Really familiar with their status. You know, when you say that, I think local draft board, because that's the institution I grew up with in the 50s and 60s, and you never had any trouble, as far as I know, in those days, you never had any trouble finding people to serve on the local draft boards.
Well, I'm just saying that that's some of the nervousness about at a very early stage about this war and the possibility of a draft came from a posting, but now there's nothing posted about it, and I actually was going to try and call up and talk to them, because I think that's still the system that would, I mean, you could make the argument that, well, you have to have some kind of reserve system in case we were actually truly attacked and threatened in
yes.
any way, which is a little...
Well, I think it's legitimate for the government to have the database on, you know, 18-year-olds, who they are, where they live, what their physical status is, and so on, in case you had some horrible event that would require a mass mobilization of the military. It's hard for me to envisage such an event, but I mean, that was the intent of Congress when they dropped conscription and went to an all-volunteer force, that there would be the requirement that the military would keep some kind of track of 18-year-olds.
Worst-case scenario, yeah.
Worst-case scenario.
You're not confused, not to be confused with the database that I referred to of,
right.
of all this personal information that apparently the Pentagon has been amassing through a private corporation. Thank you very much. I guess we're running out of time.
Yeah. Okay.
We are just about the point where we have to finish. My apologies. We have a couple of people we can't take just very quickly, and unfortunately I can't give you more time. I'm interested in your reflection on the Secretary of Defense, when he came into the position, Mr. Rumsfeld, argued that it was possible that, in fact, that he wanted to move the military toward a kind of a smaller force, something that would be more mobile, that could strike rapidly, that would take advantage of high-tech weaponry. He was talking about some fairly significant military reform. And now it seems that, though the big problem that we've had with Iraq is that's all well and good, but we come back to the phrase boots on the ground. You have to have people. You have to have soldiers. And some people have argued that in Iraq we didn't have enough from the beginning, or we weren't prepared to put enough people in there. Now, within the defense circles and people who think about this, how do people think about this idea of military reform as Secretary Rumsfeld has talked about it?
Well, I think there's general support for the direction in which Rumsfeld is going, in the sense that and the direction he's going is the direction we've been in for a long time, and that is we substitute technology for manpower when and wherever we can. And more specifically and more recently, we have been substituting long-range standoff airstrike platforms for large, heavy ground formations, which is all fine and dandy. But the problem with that is that you end up with a force structure that's very heavy on technology, kind of light on manpower, and yet the kind of counterinsurgency war that we're engaged in now, or peace enforcement operations that we've been engaged in elsewhere, they're all, by definition, manpower intensive. So it's hard to reconcile a capital-intensive force structure, a technology-intensive force structure, with the requirements of a manpower-intensive ground war. And I think that the Secretary of Defense and many others assumed that what we had done in Afghanistan could be repeated in Iraq, and there was not, they were not anticipating the kind of insurgency that emerged in the wake of the collapse of the Saddam Hussein regime, an insurgency that would require enormous number of troops.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Reckert, is professor in the Department of Strategy and International Security at the U.S. Air Force Air War College, Montgomery, Alabama. Dr. Reckert, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. We're going to break here, as we usually do, for a market update on news. When we continue, we'll have a health topic for you in the next part of Focus 580. Our guest will be dermatologist Dr. Lester Farner. We'll talk about skin and skin care. So hope that you'll stick with us.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
Well, the markets on the Chicago Board of Trade, the corn, soybeans, and wheat, reacting to easing concerns about the weather.